Okay. Next presentation will be by Valbian Pelletier.
Oh, excuse me. I've run backwards. Hang on here. There we go. Sorry.
Entitled Climate Change, Challenges and Opportunities for Mites in the High Arctic.
So what do I press here?
I don't know, because this was not... This is what you use for pointing.
I know, it's not for pointing, it's for getting to the... Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
Ah, and that is
no
forward.
Sweat. Huh? Okay, first of all, thanks a million hams for giving me the opportunity to speculate about climate, well, about the challenges for Arabatic mites in the high Arctic with climate change. What an opportunity. This is something that I probably won't be around to see, so it's kind of wonderful and total speculation. So my objectives are to look at what we know about regional patterns of Arabatic distribution in the North American Arctic and subarctic to address two questions. Are recent diversity data of any use for predicting response of Arabatids to rapid climate change in the high Arctic? And what are the possible attributes of responsive taxa? So first of all, the data set that I'm using. So most of this was collected between 1975 and 1978. It represented 800 soil and litter samples from 33 sites throughout the North American, Arctic, and subarctic. Samples were collected anywhere from 60 degrees north right up to 82 north. And the 33 sites, we had 14 from the Arctic islands, 7 Canadian sites, 12 Alaskan sites, and there was data from an additional 9 studies, 5 additional sites, and at that time the Arabatid species richness was 182 species in 78 genera and 42 families. There's been comparatively little collecting since, and except for the Western Arctic, and this is going to drive me absolutely mental because, I found it. Sorry, it won't drive me mental. Okay, except for in the Western Arctic, which is the area, especially the northern Yukon. Now, I should mention, well, let me go on to the next slide. Okay, so what are we talking about when we say high Arctic? High Arctic are the islands of the Arctic archipelago, and these are the 14, somewhere in here, are the 14 islands, or 14 sites that I had samples from. The lower part of Baffin Island is not considered high Arctic. It has quite a rich fauna, and subarctic conditions almost get into, or start to get into, the south of Baffin Island. When we look at the Arctic in general, we, or at least I divided it into the Western Arctic, areas west of the Mackenzie River, so that would include Yukon and Alaska, and then the Eastern Arctic areas east of the Mackenzie River, and as I said, the high Arctic islands, the islands of the Arctic archipelago. And I should mention, at that time I got 31 species on those islands, and even with additional collecting done by various colleagues since, that's where it stands, 31 species. So let me kind of give you kind of a framework for the Arctic. This is a system driven by abiotic factors. The July mean temperature on the Arctic islands, and you're not going to see anything because, of course, this is a color-free arrow. But in any case, if you look up there at those July mean temperatures, they are between 4 and 7 degrees July mean temperature. Ah, yikes, cold. There's absolutely no point putting on the January mean temperature because it's down around 35 or minus 35 to 40. Another factor that drives abiotic conditions in the Arctic is that the average annual precipitation is very low, around 10 to 20 centimeters annual precipitation. And all of this precipitation is in the form of snow, and I've just realized there are things missing from this image. Okay, no problem. That snow stays around, so almost all the precipitation is in the form of snow. The snow stays around for a long time, and in the high Arctic, the snow stays around for 270 days of the year. Another factor that contributes to abiotic, or another abiotic factor in the Arctic, is the presence of permafrost. The whole of the Arctic is underlain by continuous permafrost. That is permanently frozen subsoil to a depth in some places of 30 meters. Now, the microarthropods, mites, etc., are active. When they are active, they are in what is called the active layer. That is the upper layer of soil, which is in depth anything from about 2 to 30 centimeters. And this active layer freezes and thaws on an annual basis. But even in the middle of summer, if you dig down, you'll dig down about, let's say, 20 centimeters or so, you'll hit permafrost. And we also have to remember that the Arctic is a young ecosystem. Its age is certainly less than 10 million years and probably around 3 to 5 million years old. So despite these abiotic limitations, it is a very diverse, biotically diverse region. And if I start on the upper left, this is very rich tussock tundra in the Mackenzie Delta area. This is Hammer's type locality at Reindeer Station. Moving over to tussock tundra on the north slope with these dry south-facing slopes where you get rock garden type plants where you have these accumulations of detritus and organic material, and of course a very useful or very good place for finding mites. On the flat areas of the north slope, you have patterned ground caused by the annual freeze and thaw of the active layer, and of course you have many moisture is held because the moisture can't move down through the subsoil. The subsoil is frozen. Patterned ground on what different type of patterned ground on the Arctic islands, and you may be able to see little bits of red in there, which would be the Saxifraga. And as we get into more extreme Arctic islands, what are called frost boils, where the soil basically freezes and thaws on a daily basis, and so vegetation cannot become established except at the kind of the edges of these polygons. You also have vegetation on these beach ridges in the very common on the high Arctic, where you have accumulations of organic material built up on an annual basis. And however, you know, if you're flying over the Arctic, the high Arctic, much of it looks like this. This is an image from Devon Island. While I was up there, and this is in the 70s. I walked from Iqaluit Island, that little island, or that flat part up there at the top, across 3 kilometers of ocean to that hill there. And I did that in mid-July. Now, of course, that's not something that I could do today because, lots of parts of North America, the Arctic is warming. So this is recent temperature trends between 1954 and 2003 for the Arctic, the most of the Northern Hemisphere, actually, much of the Northern Hemisphere. And you can see that in comparison with years prior to 1954, there is a significant temperature increase in some of the Arctic areas. And all the IPCC models project that surface air temperature will increase in the Arctic over the next 100 years in comparison with what they were prior to the year 2000. So okay, so we have the abiotics, we have the habitats. What do the mites show? So I'm using this schematic that you've seen before that Roy used. The terminology is the same as what Roy used, and comparing the cohort representation at the species level. So these numbers to the left represent species in temperate areas in comparison with subarctic, low arctic, western, low arctic, eastern, and then high arctic. And in temperate areas, the brachypilines dominate the relative representation of species. You have again high representation of myxonomata and lowish representation of anarthronotes. But you do have both paleosomata, parahyposomata represented. All cohorts are represented at temperate areas. Let's jump to the high Arctic. Well, we could do low Arctic Eastern, but more interesting, let's jump to the high Arctic, where both the paleosomata, parahyposomata, and myxonomata drop out completely. And the anarthronotes are now a whopping, with seven species, by the way, are now a whopping 23% of species. The desmonomata are, with six species, are now 19% of the species richness, and the brachypilines are only 58% of, so they've kind of dropped from being a whopping 73% of the fauna down to 58% of the fauna. And both the anarthronotes and the desmonomata have increased their representation, or their relative representation. Clearly, the fauna of the high Arctic is a specific subset of the temperate fauna. It's not just a it's not just a gradual decrease in species richness in each cohort. Clearly, certain cohorts drop out. So let's look at those cohorts more in greater detail. So the anarthronotes, well, all you have are seven species of brachypinnated mites. The desmonomata, all you have six species of chamiseid mites. And when you get into the brachypilines, you have a primarily opioid and ceratozoetoid taxa. It's not, to me, it wasn't so much what was there, it was what was glaringly absent. So in temperate regions, these are some of the taxa you would expect to find. And they have a species richness in temperate areas comparable to the opioids and the ceratozoetoids. So for example, let's take the gustavioids. 60 species in temperate North America, no species in the high Arctic. Let's see, the galumnoids, whatever that number is, 54 species in temperate latitudes, no species in the high Arctic. And we can go on and on and on. These are just the major ones that I pulled out. This is kind of, because these are dry associated taxa, the Platyrrhamnioids, no species in the high Arctic. And probably most extraordinary to me, at least when I first saw it, the Oripidoids, over 100 species at temperate latitudes, only one species in the high Arctic, which any of you could name. Okay, so my question first of all was, are there particular physiological traits that the brachypinnids, that the desmonomata and the ceratozoetoids have that other arabatids don't have? And this was some work I pulled together in 1999, and really there is, so the brachypilines, and I should say this thing here is the poronotic brachypiline, I've pulled them out just for a reason, but when we look at this data, these are not negative signs, there is no evidence. So we have lots, some evidence for thermoregulation, for supercooling, for presence of cryoprotectants, for desiccation tolerance, anaerobiosis tolerance in brachypylines, a tiny amount in the Desmonomata, and an insignificant amount in the anarthronotes, but we have just no data for these other groups. So we can't say anything about these traits being, let's say, adaptations. We don't have, as I said, we have no data from the outgroups in the Arabatids, and we have no data from outgroups in the endiostegs and in many of the other, or endiostegs, and, well, that's about as far out as I would want to go. Another question I asked myself was, were these groups being selectively dispersed to the high Arctic? Now, none of these taxa are known to be good phoretics. In fact, there's so little evidence for phoretics. But there has been some work lately on dispersal on birds. So Arabatic mites being dispersed on birds. And so I pulled out data from Lebedeva and Krivolutsky 2003 and put it along this axis. Here we have it along here. So these are genera species. And clearly this is not just a, this is a subset of what you would find in temperate areas. This is not a, there is nothing selective about what is on bird feathers. They, and these are birds that were sampled on Arctic islands. So they were kind of dispersing mites to Arctic islands. It's not that these taxa are found normally on Arctic islands, but at least they were found on the birds. And this is not a selective group. It is more a subset of a temperate fauna. Now, will I back up here a bit? When we looked at these physiological traits, most of the data actually we have, or a lot of the data we have, these plus pluses here, are from ceratozoid taxa. So, for example, we have evidence of passive thermoregulation, long generation times, well, big deal actually in Arabatic mites, but for cryoprotection, for supercooling, desiccation tolerance, anoxia tolerance within ceratozoid mites. But again, this is very nice. We know it for ceratozoids, but we really don't. The outgroups haven't been tested. All the brachypineids, the chamisia, and we know are Thalitticus, are parthenogenetic. It's possible that all of the opioids are as well, but I've put this in light green because I need to check all of this. So that is a possible reason why they are doing well in the high Arctic. But why are the ceratozoids doing well in the high Arctic? And it just happens that Heinz Schatz and myself have a paper in press on ceratozoid biogeography, biogeography North America. So that allowed me to ask the question, why are ceratozoids doing so well in the high Arctic? So just a brief run through what some of the things that we found. First of all, ceratozoids in North America, there are six families, 32 genera, 125 species. They're found in a range of habitats. For this is a photo Roy Norton took, and I know we could probably find his tent in here, and I'm out here in the suburbs. And this is a group that found in the Arctic, found in the canopy of many trees, of course found in forest type situations, and also found on the marine littoral. Heinz and myself placed what we knew about species distributions. Obviously, most species are known on the basis of ecological collections, from states or provinces, but we used the Flora of North America framework a framework that's used in the Flora of North America to place family the number on the left is family, genus, and species on 12 geographical regions. So basically, the Nearctic was or North America, including Greenland, was divided into 12 geographical regions. One of the things that this showed, this analysis showed, was that most ceratozoids are actually quite specific to a geographical region. So with the 12 geographical regions, 57% of species are restricted to one geographical region, and 82% of species are restricted to either one to three geographical regions. So whereas Mark Moran suggested that arabatids are generalists that inhabit wide niches, certainly that doesn't seem to hold up on ceratozoids. Okay. This analysis also allowed us to look at biogeographic elements of North American ceratozoidea. And almost 60% of North American ceratozoids are Nearctic, have a Nearctic distribution. The next highest representation is Amphiatlantic, that is found on both in both eastern North America and the western Palearctic, and a small component component is Amphibaryngian, that is found in both western Yukon and Alaska, I should say, and on the other side of the Bering Strait. When we look at the Nearctic element, break it out. The largest component is this Carolinian Austroriparian biogeographic component, and the next highest is this component found in East Beringia, that is found in Yukon and Alaska. So if we kind of add up these two figures, we find that the Carolinian Austroriparian element is a whopping 40% of the fauna, and the Beringian component, including Amphibaryngian and East Beringian, is a very large 18.4% of the fauna. So I'm just going to hop over here. Now, if we put that data on a net primary productivity map of North America, to me I think it's fascinating. You have this Amphibaryngian-Beringian element that is in an area of low net primary productivity, and then this Amphiatlantic and Carolinian element in an area of high net primary productivity. And those are the biggest faunal biogeographic faunal elements. So to address why is this, I think we need to go back to when this ceratozoids evolved. Now, this is work by Ina Schaefer, her thesis, which is in the process of, which will be published soon, I'm sure she hopes. And the brachypilines broke away from the Desmonomata lineage about the Jurassic. That's about 200 million years ago. The ceratozoids that she used in this study are the little stars. And from her work, which was based on 18S, their age is about 20 to 40 million years. And this corresponds to data we have on fossil ceratozoids. So we have fossil ceratozoids from 40 million years ago from the Lower Eocene. Now, what was the climate like in the Lower Eocene? Well, of course, it wasn't remotely like what we have today. The whole of North America was lovely and warm, and you had it was quite blissful the whole way up to the high Arctic. And so this certainly would explain our Amphiatlantic Carolinian element, this was a period of time when there was a connection basically from Palearctic to the Nearctic, and it was a warm temperate fauna, a time when warm temperate fauna could evolve. It's only when we get down to the 40 million years ago that things start to cool off. And on the left-hand side here, I just put some temperatures from the time of Jurassic to present. And at present, we're at one of the coldest times from a geological standpoint. So Brachypilina and ceratizoids were evolving at a time when temperatures were warm. So how do we have this Beringian element? Well, of course, 18 to 22,000 years ago, we had, 18 to 30,000 years ago, Northern North America was covered by the Laurentian ice sheet. And the only area that was not covered by that sheet was the area south of that, Carolinian, Austro-Riparian area south of the sheet, and Beringia. And I suppose we think of Beringia as being a little narrow bridge the Bering area today, a little narrow bridge that runs from Alaska, Nome, Alaska, across to Chukotka. But the Bering Land Bridge was latitudinally the same latitude as Alaska is today. It was an enormously wide area that we know was dry, it was a dry, grassy plains. This is, I don't believe it. What's going on here? This is, hang on for a second, page down. Oh, thanks to God. So, you didn't hear that. Okay, so what about this ceratozoid 5, that five species that are found in the high Arctic? Okay, and they are Diaptera, Betes, Notatus, Melan, blah, 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 those five. You can read them as well as I. Well, the one on the left is a tramp. It is actually found in both temperate areas and right up to the high Arctic, and it's the one ceratozoetid that Lebedeva showed carried on feathers. All the others, okay, they're not specifically restricted to the Beringian area today, but my hypothesis is that they survived the last glacial maximum in Beringia. And that associated of course, along with a number of other taxa, but that associated with traits such as cold tolerance, blah blah blah, gave them, as it were, a head start on dispersing to the high Arctic. How did they get to the high Arctic? I would postulate that they were probably blown there. And I should have mentioned earlier on that all of these are sexual species. So will I be able to ever test this hypothesis? The Northern Insect Survey was done by in Canada between 1947 to whatever, 50 whatever there. Actually, I can read it here, 1947 to 58, and they went to and collected all these sites. It was an insect survey, they didn't do mites. There is a number of people are hoping to get funding to do this again, and certainly mites will be incorporated into this. And I would put down bets, as it were, maybe not too much, maybe Roy Norton $2, that the taxa that we will find moving into high Arctic areas will be species that are found today in the Western Arctic. They're found today in the Western Arctic. However, who knows? Because as somebody, Monty Wood, who knows a lot more about Arctic areas, said to me, the way climate is changing, if you could have changes in moisture patterns, so in fact the high Arctic may end up being not a dry environment, but one that is comparatively moist. So I won't even bother with the conclusions. Ceratozoetoids are one of the few brachypiline taxa represented in the high Arctic. There's evidence for a strong Beringian influence on these taxa, and I see them as being a possible source area for dispersal to the high Arctic. I think the ceratozoetoids have a heads up on other taxa because they have physiological traits that are, in a sense, pre-adaptations for colonization to the dry habitats found in high Arctic landscapes. Thank you very much. Any questions? or if I stunned you all. Whew. Well, okay, spot on.
Okay, well, let me, as I mentioned before, the last presentation by Dave Walter has been cancelled, so this is the end of this symposium. I would like to thank all the speakers. I thought there were some excellent presentations. Thank you very much. We can have a brief break here, and then hopefully please come back for the business meeting. We would like to have some folks there in, say, 10 minutes or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm They were there. They don't really know very well. If climate changes, they get crushed and they will not be here.
No, I think actually,
yeah, we've been there. Should we get started?
Yeah.
Okay, folks, shall we try and get started?
We can do this.
Everyone to our business meeting with the Agrological Society of America. The most prestigious agrologist, please step forward and become president for next year. We're not allowed to do that early. But anyway, we'll be electing offices for next year. But we're going to start out with our agenda first by giving a financial report of the status of our society. That will be Hans, Tom, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Yes, I think I'm as ready as I will be. One point, the minutes from the last meeting, since we've had issues with the newsletter, we'll get back to that later. If anybody wants to see the minutes, you know the minutes. We'll put them in the next newsletter, whatever it comes out with the minutes for this year.
So, two for one.
And after this meeting. Treasurer report. Let's see. We started off with a nice balance of $14,729.80. And we end the year after going through current expenses with $14,122.20. A little bit less, but we had to do some extra subsidies for today's symposium speakers, so I think overall we did pretty good. We had a pretty good balance for the year. A couple of other things to mention. Membership status. We at this point, the society has 193 members that are in, I would consider in good status, that is either their life or meritus, which I can't blame. Or they're active members, or student members, or sustaining members that have paid at least for this year. And okay, if you miss 1 year, I'll give you that grace period. You drop off the list, by the way, if you miss 2 years in a row. That includes, in fact, the 17 student members, which is really not that bad for our society. I mean, it's not fantastic, but we've had a lot worse years. There's another two other items that I should mention. Last year, we decided to
raise the fees a little bit, and then at the same time offer as part of the membership benefits an electronic subscription to Systematic and Applied Acrology. That seems to have worked relatively well. If there's anybody that had issues there, they were members, they didn't get access, let me know. By the way, there is one modification here. If you were a Life or Emeritus member, you actually have to pay extra for the journal. Sorry, we're not having the other members pay for that. There were about 20 Life and Emeritus members that signed up for SAA, so we seem to have gotten some reasonable response for that so far. The other item was that last year I proposed maybe starting with an online possibility to pay dues online through this Activa service. I set that up. 28 members used this, many of them foreign, and that was really my primary target group, those folks that have issues sending in dues in US dollars from countries that don't live on US dollars. So that seems to have worked relatively well. I should mention that I will be migrating that account from Activa to a different provider in the next year, and that will be mostly because OSU seems to not like Activa, or they're okay with it, but they prefer another service provider. I will go with that for the Acrology Summer Program, and if I'm going to do it for one, I'm going to do it for both. It makes it a lot easier for me. That, I think, is most of the Treasurer and Secretary report. Just as an aside, if you want to pay me for next year, feel free to do so.
Thank you very much, Hans. It's a good report. Glad we have some fun. The next item on our agenda is to mention the deceased acrologist from last year. We have five that passed away. Dr. Don Chan from Canada, Dr. Shozu Ihara, Japan, Tom Abiro in Georgia, Bluff Hopla, and Wayne Hans. And I think that covers the deceased acrologists, unless any of you might know of anyone else that has passed away. Try to keep up with it. You said a vote of assignments or something? Why don't we just have a vote of assignments in regards to. Okay, our next topic is to elect officers for the next year. And I made some ballots that we had set up, but I guess the summary is we have
we
president elect.
We have, well, we have at this point actually, I think the thing is we also accept nominations from the floor. At this point, we. Kenpo, do you want me to go on with this?
Sure.
At this point, we have for the executive committee candidate Quentin Fine, who has been sitting in for Ashley already and taking part of this session after Ashley got promoted or demoted, depending on how you feel about it, to the next president. So Quentin is one candidate. Mariam Lekbishvili has agreed to be a candidate, and Will Reeves. So all the candidates there nicely in the row, which is really pleasant. Anybody else that wants would like to stand, or what that you want to nominate for the executive?
You can nominate people that aren't here.
We have no problems with that. But I think we have one problem in that we don't have any nominations yet for president. Now, potentially we could delay on that, and if you come up with names, of especially of people that are not here, that we just call up and threaten them and make them see the light. Or any of you three candidates here of the executive committee, if you want to do so. But I think it would be nicer if we could have name goes now. It would also be nice if we had at least two candidates. If you can't do it now, I personally would suggest that we go and track bodies down and do it as an email election.
May I nominate someone who's already been running for the executive committee?
Sure.
I'd like to nominate Quentin Palm for president.
I'll second.
Quentin?
Yeah.
Are you not protesting very violently? Okay, he's a candidate.
Sorry. We like to nominate.
There's also actually there's two other positions that we need to fill. That the newspaper editor Harold Howland has done a nice job for several years, but wasn't really planning to do this forever. And I guess forever is has come close. He wants to get out of this job. If any one of you wants to do that, we have a possible replacement, Mike McAloon, in a moment of not paying attention, mentioned in one email that he might want to be willing to do some of these things. Mike McAloon, by the way, is on the executive board right now, couldn't come to this meeting, but that shouldn't stop us from nominating him for that. And also, finally, the job of Secretary Treasurer, which I have loved as long as I've had it. I'm perfectly ready to hand that over. And actually, Jim has volunteered to take that one on.
Yes, I'm nuts.
Gotten for punishment. So, potentially, we have all the jobs filled. Unfortunately, we don't have actually a single competitive election.
We could just do a yes, no, aye, or nay vote.
I don't think we could do that.
How about if we ask? Let's hang on. So, all of those that would approve of this slate of electees to new offices, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Okay.
Now, the next topic is, what topic will we have for next year? This year was soils, soil mites. Last year, we had parasitic mites. The year before that, we had molecular methods. And a suggestion was made that we might be time for us to look at plant feeding mites. So that's a topic we thought about today. Are there any other topics that you'd like to bring forward for next year's symposium? It will be held in Indianapolis. Is that right? Indianapolis, Indiana. What's the date?
In December.
Back in December. Later in the year. Might not be easy to travel to Indianapolis.
You can do agriculturally important mites instead of just plant feeding, and you could actually possibly pick up some of the honeybee people.
That's possible. What is the next phase, and this is actually the most important one, is to find one or two people that are willing to organize it. That is, try to find people. The problem with anything that we do is that we need to have a list of people that are going to be talking by April.
February.
So it's ridiculously
early. You can get names in, but then you have to finalize it by like June or something.
Yeah,
so
but you have to get something in
at least initially.
David James was the one that proposed. Can I nominate David for this?
Sure.
I see. David James would be one co-nominee. Bill, if you want to join with David, maybe.
If it was agricultural, I would. Because I work in the
USDA. Let's call it agricultural.
Okay, and then if you two contact each other, and please let's say Jim or Ashley know that yes, you contact each other and yes, you're going to do it.
That sounds good. Agriculturally important mites, does that sound like a good title?
Well, if you find something more exciting as a title, I think we give you the some leeway on coming up with that.
I'd like to ask Ashley to give the results of the various awards. Do you want to cover both the Travel Awards and the Paper Award?
So we have a, every year we have the Travel Award for students. They can submit an abstract for the talk they're going to give. Do a little pleading and begging about how far they have to travel, if they got no money. This year, I guess I'm just feeling sympathetic. And so we gave out two awards. We didn't give one out last year, so it all evened out. And so this year's awards go to Samantha Colby and Caitlin Strong. So they both get a $200 check, courtesy of the ASA, to help pay for travel. And so yeah, I talked to Hans, they'll hand the money over. And then the student competition, we had six talks. I think they were all very good talks. I'm glad to see that many students. Hopefully next year we get six or seven again, and we just get more students every year. And it was a close race, but the winner of the student competition was Caitlin.
All right.
Yeah, we pulled it out. There's a good talk, and Hans, there's another check for that. Plus you get a plaque.
She gets this very briefly, and then she gives it back to me.
So he can engrave it.
So we can engrave it.
We'll make Hans actually engrave it.
But actually, Samantha, can you come here too, and we'll take care of this right now. That you're lucky. Oh, I have to fill the
name.
I didn't have to fill in the money first.
Travel award. One more award that I should mention, because the Agrological Society is also thanks. The Cayman Award. The Cayman Award is in conjunction with the Entomological Foundation. This year we had four applicants for that, all four non-US, and the winner, we ended up with the person living the farthest away and not coming here, Jeanette Weber in New Zealand. She's actually a student of Rob Cruikshank. But folks, if you have students that are interested in coming, say, to the summer program, please let them apply for this Cayman Award. Last year was great. We had four or five U.S. competitors. This year we're back to no U.S. competitors. I have no problem giving it to somebody not U.S., but it's kind of nice if you at least have somebody in the race. So that's another one that should be.
What's the deadline?
The deadline is, I usually shift it all kind of ways, but it tends to be late September to early October. I think this year we made it to the 10th of October.
Another announcement is that tomorrow evening, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., the company Taylor & Francis, who bought, I think, the International Journal of Agrology, will be having a reception for agrologists. Will be in room A8. Just know what way it's here. So, I mean, it's A13. 8:13, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. And free beer, is that right?
Yes, that's free drinks.
Free drinks. And snacks and other items there. So if you're a non-drinker, come anyway. Well, I guess we could ask if there's any items to be brought up from the floor, any concerns?
Just about the newsletter, Harold sent me a nearly complete version about 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, and I was just busy getting ready for this meeting to fly out next morning, so I should have something put together and sent out in the next week after this meeting. Unfortunately, it's after the meeting. The list of those papers, you know, and a few other things.
Did you add the results of the election?
Well,
Audio sent this newsletter, and he sent the next one with the minutes of this meeting and the results of the 2-6, and then we have something to quickly fire out January, February, or something like that. That really has something to hold that whole thing.
And our goal was to have 2 newsletters a year. We've fallen for that a few times now, but maybe we can finally get on that track.
Yes, Ron.
Do we have any information on how actually it will change, or if it will change format, or
the journal format, they're going to try and keep it pretty much the same as it has been. I think they're going to increase the number of color images, color on the front, maybe color on the back, and I think they're saying that they're going to have 5 performance journals.
6 issues
a year is what they're shooting for. They may not be able to make it this year. They may be just more in 2009. But 2010, they'd like to go to 6 issues a year. And they may increase it after that. They're going to have a pretty liberal policy on charging fees, from what I understand. So that if you have no funds at all, just mention that, they might be able to give you a break as far as fees costs. So they're trying to get it launched and off to a good start. And they'll probably have more information tomorrow. I'm going to be an interim. I'm not really used to being called that. But basically, what I do is looking to help keep the papers along. Try to address problems that are in English from other languages, and then make sure everything is pretty much up to snuff by the time it is printed, and try to catch any errors. I don't always catch the errors, and I may have gotten through, and I apologize for that. But I will continue for maybe 1 or 2 more years, and then they may come up with their own people that they would want to hold that position and other positions. Jay Yoder is going to be helping quite a bit with eating out the new manuscripts out of the review. And that's a topic that will really need some help with this reviewers willing to look at these papers and get them into a rough sort of shape. Again, it makes it easier than we have individual editor chiefs with different groups of mics. But if you're interested in editing, let me know, or let any of us know, and we'll feed that on to Jay Yoder and whoever else might be helping in doing that. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, any plans for online access?
I believe they're going to try to have every copy of every issue of IJA online here within the next year. And Vicki sent most of those to the company, and I think they're in the process of doing PDFs to get them ready for online. I'm not sure what kind of charges we're going to take. I haven't learned all of the details yet. I haven't been given any kind of contract to sign for myself. It's what I'll be doing, since it's a good company. They're located in London. They have some 600 or 800 journals that they publish. So they know all about publishing journals, but they don't pay too much for clients. And so they'll need a lot of help from a lot of agrologists here in this country and around the world, actually. Any other questions regarding IJA or anything else that we discussed today? Or society? I guess we have any more questions about that. That leaves only about 1 more job left to be done, doesn't it? Ashley, would you like to go forward? This is our new president of the Acrological Society of America. And here is your gavel, your sign of badge of honor. And then since I'll be the secretary, I guess I can help you out. If you have any problems, let me know.
Perfect. And before we finish here, we've got a plaque for Jim to thank him for his year of service as president. Got a little mug to have it, and appreciate it. And then I think my only duty is to say that at the end of it, and everyone can go home, and we'll see you next year.
Okay. Well done.
Okay, if anybody still wants to give me money, or check whether I got their address correctly, you should do that.
Right. If you give me money, that's the whole thing out of the way.
Yeah. At least spell your name out so I know who gave you money.
Hey, fellow, I can just take all this. Yeah.
is and make sure that that's the case. And I'll try and send a message out to the membership that if you don't get the response from John, well, I'm going to be sending the membership reminders this coming month. And I've learned from non-bashing that you always send them not just email, but also send them by regular mail, right? Because then you get more. Yes. If you're a student, okay, you're a student, yes. Yes. Do you have to be your startup? Do you have 10 bucks?
No, you pay the 10 bucks. That's temporary faculty. So she's equivalent to assistant professor, but it's on a three year contract. So she's hoping that they will be able to hire her, but I don't know, it's just something towards a hiring freeze for new faculty. Apparently, it's just,
they wiped it out. Well, they were flooded, I know that. Oh, so they can't get everybody to work, and therefore they'd rather not pay it.
They also said
it's financial problems. So this gave them a fantastic excuse. So watch out, if there's a hurricane coming and you're going to say, you better have your CV updated.
Why?
Oops, sorry, you have it wrong. That doesn't matter, I'm down.
Thank you. between different places on that.
I'm Thank you very much.
Thanks for all the work I'm sure you do.
the workhorse.
He's the workhorse. You just get us take the credit.
No, I'd say actually these meetings are.